Decades, Mejorans has been catering to the needs of the Mad River Valley and beyond. We have custom-cut meats, fresh produce and seafood, regular and organic grocery, locally produced foods galore, topped off by an extraordinary wine and beer department and a state liquor agency. Shop Mejorans Supermarket, Village Square Shopping Center, Waitsfield.
All right, we're back. Let's head to the phone. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Fritz Schwartz, who is the author of Democracy in the Dark. Mr. Schwartz was the lead counsel, chief counsel on the U.S. Senate Church Committee, which was 40 years ago, unbelievable, and which looked into abuses, government abuses, and to privacy of American individuals. That might sound a little bit familiar. Fritz, thank you for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm happy to be on your show.
You know what I had forgotten is that I remember that the Church Committee, which was led by Frank Church, Democrat of Idaho, was looking at the CIA, but I had forgotten that it also looked at the NSA.
And the FBI, and actually, in my opinion, our most important findings were about the FBI, although NSA and CIA also were.
I wonder why, you know, I, and I think probably most people, would identify the Church Committee with the CIA. That's so interesting.
The CIA is sexy, and people remember the CIA.
Yeah.
And, of course, we did find out some very terrible things about the CIA, like trying to assassinate Fidel Castro and hiring the mafia to do it, or like using LSD on people without telling them they were using it. It was, they were experimenting to see the effects of LSD, if you question people.
Mm-hmm.
So those were two examples. And then also a lot of domestic surveillance, which was outside the charter of the CIA.
Now, this all came grew out of Watergate. Is that fair to say?
Well, you know, it's, I think it's broader than that. I think in the mid-70s, when we started, there'd begun to be a worry about what government was doing. Now, Watergate was part of it, but the Vietnam War also. And journalists had been playing a role in revealing things that were, you know, concerning the American public. Like Rampart's magazine had an article about the CIA controlling the National Student Association. And Seymour Hersh had his stories about the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. And Seymour Hersh also had some stories that were in the New York Times about surveillance by the CIA of anti-war people and civil rights people in America. So it's broader than Watergate, although Watergate was very important.
Mm-hmm. How did Hersh get on to that story of the domestic surveillance? Do you know?
I don't know. I think someone in the CIA leaked it to him, but I don't know that for sure.
Okay. So when the Church Committee first met,
when
the Church Committee first met, was there any idea where this was going? Was this just a sort of, I don't want to use the word fishing expedition, but I think you know what I mean.
I think it's fair to say we had no idea how bad the situation was. I'll give a, but we, there were hints that there were bad things being done by the intelligence agencies, but we had no idea how bad they were. And most importantly, I think our single most important fact, which shows this is not a partisan problem, is that the abuses of secrecy had started in Franklin Roosevelt's administration and run all the way through Nixon's, four Democratic presidents and two Republicans. And they'd all cause problems with abusing secrecy.
Wow. What was going on back during Roosevelt's time?
Well, Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, at J. Edgar Hoover's request, secretly, without telling the Congress and without telling the American public, greatly expanded Hoover's, J. Edgar Hoover's, power to investigate law-abiding Americans by saying he could investigate what they called, quote, subversion, which is a term that is so loose that it led eventually to Hoover infiltrating the women's liberation movement, for example. Roosevelt did that secretly at the request of Hoover, and with the approval of his attorney general, Roosevelt said, well, I don't want the Congress to know about this, and we're not going to tell the American public about it.
Mm-hmm. At the conclusion of the Church Committee hearings, what was put into place that was supposed to safeguard our privacy?
I think your word is good, supposed. There were a number of things. The two most important were that there were intelligence committees created in both the House and the Senate. Before that, the Congress had, as far as the FBI and the CIA and the NSA, which nobody knew anything about, were concerned, the Congress had sort of had a don't ask, don't tell, and they sort of told the intelligence agencies, please don't tell us what you're doing. And so after the Church Committee, both the House and the Senate, the Senate was where Church was, and the House followed suit, set up committees that would oversee the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was the FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Before our work, the FBI and in this country had, without any warrants, gotten the power to wiretap Americans or put bugs in their hotel rooms, for example, like they did with Martin Luther King.
Right.
The Congress created the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which required the government to get a warrant before doing any wiretapping or bugging of hotel rooms or bedrooms or living rooms. And those both, I think, worked reasonably well until 9/11, and they're still better than what there was before. But in each case, I think after 9/11, the old secrecy habits have come back, and the court has been weakened a little bit. The court has been asked to do things that really are the job of the legislature and not of a court. And the oversight by the committees has become sometimes not really vigorous oversight. Now, there's been some examples of good oversight, like the report on torture that the Senate Intelligence Committee, led by Dianne Feinstein, came out with, you know, whatever it was, 10 months ago or something like that.
Yep. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, and you also mentioned 9/11, because I was going to ask you, we're talking with Fritz Schwartz, who's the author of Democracy in the Dark. He was the chief counsel for the Church Committee. I was going to ask you if you really had any sort of feeling after the Church Committee, for any period of time after that, that everybody was honoring the rules. And it sounds like maybe you feel like they kind of were up until 9/11.
Yeah, I think it was much better up until 9/11. It's interesting. I went back to private practice after the Church Committee, and then I went into government again to be the head lawyer for New York City. But for about 10 years after the Church Committee, I'd get telephone calls all the time from newspaper people who were looking into this, that, or the other thing. And then that sort of ended. And then after 9/11, they all started all over again. As people had interest in what is the government doing, and is the government exceeding the bounds that are meant to be placed on its activities.
Mm-hmm. You tell me what your thoughts are on 9/11. You feel as though there was the information out there to prevent this?
Well, I actually, that's a very, very good question. I think the CIA gave the White House, in what are called presidential daily briefs, a number of really scary warnings about Al-Qaeda planning a far more calamitous, far more dangerous, far more deaths event. Now, in the book, I say, if that information had been made public by the White House, the gist of the information, they don't have to say what the source was, but the gist of the information had been made public by the White House, I think it's extremely likely that 9/11 would have been prevented. First, because the people in the FBI who were noticing there were an awful lot of people of investigative interest, Arabs of investigative interest, who were taking flying lessons, mm-hmm. but nothing happened because of that. Had those people in the FBI been told that there are warnings that Al-Qaeda is going to have calamitous, gigantic attacks, I think we would have taken action. And if the public had been told, I think the public would have thought about it and would have said, you know, how can they do something truly calamitous, and would have thought of using airplanes as flying bombs. Now, nobody did something wrong, or nobody did something that was malicious in the White House by failing to disclose those warnings. And what I do in the book is to say, you know, one of the dangers of government secrecy is that once something is stamped secret, particularly stamped top secret, people stop thinking. They don't think any longer about whether the information should be made public. They just let the secrecy roll on without thought.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an example of a point I make that you know, contrary to conventional wisdom, classification isn't the only problem. It's also the loss of thought that flows from a something having been stamped top secret. And there's another interesting psychological consequence. Right now, in recent times, about 100 million documents are stamped secret or top secret each year, and about 20 million are declassified each year.
Hmm.
So there are so many documents floating around that are top secret. And the one consequence is secrecy, in effect, spawns more secrecy. Because if you're a bureaucrat and you want somebody to pay attention to your document, if you don't try to find a way to stamp it top secret, people are going to think it's unimportant and not pay attention to it. So the more secrecy there is, the more secrecy that is spawned or generated. So there's sort of a vicious circle there.
Wow. When all the Edward Snowden stuff came out, and I guess in the years before that, we were learning about the wiretap or the trunks, being able to get access to the trunks of the phone companies, things like that. So when all the Edward Snowden stuff came out, you just were completely nonplussed, right?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have said quite that because there were some hints about it. But Snowden opened a debate, and whatever one thinks about how Snowden should be looked at, it's clear he was acting to try to help the Democratic debate in this country. He was acting as a patriot. Whether he did something legal or illegal is a different question, but his motive was to be a patriot. My analysis of Snowden in the book is a little different than what we usually read, because what we usually read is it exposes breaches of privacy, or it exposes action that could be said to be illegal. My point is that the real fault of George W. Bush when he initiated the Snowden program, we can call it a shorthand, the Snowden program, when he initiated it, and Barack Obama when he continued it, they should have had what I call a democratic dialogue about whether the NSA should be collecting metadata, you know, the thing that they all calls, yeah. Every single call in the United States, they collect who made it, where was it to, how long did it last, that kind of information. And the argument I make in the book is that that's the sort of decision that should not be made without a public democratic dialogue. There was no real risk in national security to revealing what the government wanted to do. It's not going to change Al-Qaeda's behavior. Al-Qaeda already would have thought their content of their telephone calls was being listened to, and so
right.
The fact that the metadata was being collected wouldn't matter. And we should have had a democratic discussion. And it's another example of the point that too often secrecy just happens without thought and without regard to thinking about our democratic values, which are based on, just if you take Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, that marvelous speech, which finishes by saying it's vital for America to preserve government of the people, by the people, and for the people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't have a government by the people unless the people are given as much information as they possibly can be.
Mm-hmm. Last question. So, you know, I mean, you've got a good perspective on this. So have we made really any improvement on not spying on our citizens here? And when you look back at the Church Committee, is it almost kind of quaint when you look at it?
Well, yes, but we do it a little too much still. I think the government is a little more wary of doing things that are going to be excessive, but they're still doing them. So we haven't reached the promised land yet. We should always strive to get there, isn't that what radio broadcasters and lawyers and writers all try to do?
Absolutely. And sometimes they actually try to do it together.
Yeah. Yes. I think the one of the sub-themes in my book is that journalism has been absolutely vital to America's success. I mean, James Madison way back then said that the real sovereign, that was his words, in a democracy is public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if the public isn't informed, it's not going to be able to form an opinion.
Well said. Thank you for your time this morning. I really appreciate it very much.
My son went to the University of Vermont, so I've always been a big fan of that place up there.
Well, my dad ran Brown Wood, so I think he's pretty familiar with your firm as well, too. Thank you for
your... Indeed, he is.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for your time this morning. Fritz Schwartz.
Okay.
Fritz Schwartz, the author. And by the way, he's Frederick A. O. Schwartz. So, yes, F. A. O. Schwartz, great-grandson of the toy store. He is the author of Democracy in the Dark. He was the chief counsel for the Church Committee, Senator Frank Church's committee in the mid-70s, looking at abuses by the CIA, the NSA, and the FBI. Wow. Amazing, huh? You know, it all comes full circle once again. And again, the name of the book, Democracy in the Dark. I know it's a little bizarre for me to tell you on a day like today that it's a really great time of the year to head up to the Lake Champlain Islands, but it is. And our friends at Shoreacres Inn and Restaurant, you know, all of this is going to melt and it's going to seem like a distant memory in just a few days. So encourage you to head up and see our friends in beautiful North Arrow, Vermont at Shoreacres Inn and Restaurant, where they're serving up dinner Friday and Saturday nights here in the early season, Friday and Saturday nights. So take advantage of that. Head on up and see Chef Dan Rainville and enjoy some of those fabulous crab cakes, maybe a nice little fish special after that. And also they serve up delicious steak and vegetarian specials as well, too. You will not leave with an empty belly at Shoreacres Inn and Restaurant, a beautiful setting right on Lake Champlain. You'll be looking right down at Mount Mansfield and to the right, Camel's Hump, up to the left there, Jay Peak, so you get the full panorama. At Shoreacres Inn and Restaurant in beautiful North Hero, Vermont. Give them a call today at 372-8722. That's 372-8722. Shoreacres Inn and Restaurant in beautiful North Hero, Vermont. Just a short drive, but another world away.
At the Honda Dream Garage sales event, we've got great deals on almost everything we make. Are you the sporty type into neatly manicured lawns? How about the snazzy Civic with rear view camera standard? And this handy lawnmower?
Eat this dandelion.
All terrain on the brain, Road trip in a stylish Accord on Saturday and off-road in a Honda side-by-side. Woo-hoo! And for you amphibious types, conquer both land and sea in a new Pilot and a fancy four-stroke marine engine for your aquatic vessel. Yarr! Whatever you're into, the Honda Dream Garage sales event has got great deals for just about everything. Now go! You've got a garage to fill, and we've got more innovations to unleash.
During the Dream Garage sales event, get 0.9% APR financing for well-qualified buyers on a 2015 Civic, Accord, and Pilot.
Visit your local North Country Honda dealer or online at northcountryhondadealers.com.
See your local dealer for financing details.
The Vermont Bed Store knows that having a mattress you love to sleep on is important. After all, the average person spends nearly a third of their life in bed. That's why the Vermont Bed Store is proud to offer you the best selection and diversity of mattresses and furnishings in town. Our hardwood, cherry, and maple furniture offers you fine Vermont craftsmanship and country-inspired style, customized so you can create the bedroom of your dreams and avoid a price that gives you nightmares. Our high-quality memory foam mattresses respond to your body for personalized comfort. And our popular Ergo Via mattress is one of the most comfortable in the shop. It's crafted using sustainable practices and certified organics with 100% latex. The Ergo Via is guaranteed for comfort and durability for 20 years, and you can only get it at the Vermont Bed Store. Come visit the Vermont Bed Store at 4050 Williston Road. If one third of your life is spent in bed, let's make it the best third.
Hi, this is Trish from Always On Time Signs and Designs, and our graphic design department is pleased to announce the addition of a professional photographer to our design team. Gray Ricker, a graduate of Hallmark Institute of Photography, is now available for all your photography needs. Always On Time Signs and Designs can now provide you with an expert that can help you enhance your sales by showcasing your products and services with professional quality images.
Hi, I'm Gray Ricker. I'm excited to be a part of the Always On Time Signs and Designs graphic design team, and I invite you to check out my work at grayricker.com. Feel free to contact me directly at my email at gray@grayricker.com. I look forward to working with you.
Call Always On Time Signs and Designs at 223-1362 or 800-547-0808. Check out their new website at alwaysontimesigns.com for more information. Always On Time Signs and Designs, for signs of all kinds.
Vermont is a tight-knit community. We want our small businesses to thrive, and we want what's best for our families and our children. That's why Vermont needs to pass a bill allowing working families to earn paid sick days. Paid leave allows parents to care for a sick child.